The Philosophy of Evolution, Part 2.
How many?
Well, how many, right? Sigbert. Did you get the handout?
No.
Would you like to have it?
Yes.
It's right there on the table.
This is the plus and minus of the measure.
Please. There's a place in front there if you want. Yeah, he just reminded me that the Philosophy of Evolution, Part 2, is called Mind and Supermind.
That's what I saw.
Right, you're right. And we've been exploring for the last couple of weeks what mind might be. Or what it is, maybe, if we're able to make that determination. So, does anybody know yet? Have a good idea, at least? Maybe a direct perceptual grasp of it? I'm open to suggestions. We've been gathering and dwelling on this subject of mind for three weeks. So what is it? Yeah, but what is the mental? Yes.
Maybe definite as a evolution or involution of practice. Because if you see.
You're defining a metaphysical process. So when you're walking around deciding what you're going to pay for your next set of encyclopedias, is that you define that process as the involution of Prakriti? Or is that some kind of economic decision that you're making?
No, but in this case, you are the author of the encyclopedia. You write it. So when you produce something, evolve, it means it is a double process. You have to know it and you have to manifest it.
So knowing and manifesting.
Yes.
That's what you mean by mind.
No, because it has a source. There's the origin of mind, which is, in this case, hierarchy, supermind. This is true, no? In a sense, but this is.
We don't know doodly about supermind, so don't even bother. we're trying to focus our consciousness on what mind is. And the very first line that we read from the synthesis of yoga in the beginning said, man is a mental being. Woman also is a mental being. the human being is a Homo sapiens sapiens. And this is a class on evolution, not a class on metaphysics. So we start at the bottom, not at the top. So don't tell me anything about supermind, please.
I made a note that says mind is the time-space unfolding of dualities.
So whenever you order your new encyclopedias for Christmas, that's the unfolding of the dualities in my in time and space, right?
I think this is quoted from you.
Yes, but one thing that I advise you never to do.
For a longer time, and it is that I understood more deeply, and I said things has to go deep in, that we have a mind which is not what we from the West know, the mental bubbling only, but also the feeding from the senses, from all these senses, to really understand what mind
feeling.
The senses, all the senses. The senses,
Sense mind.
Sense mind.
So one thing that mind is is sensation.
Yeah, and I think Sri Aurobindo also saying that, but also sensation. I think it's in the supramental part. Everything is mind. I mean, also about what.
Well, but that's a pure speculation. I'm wondering what we can know.
No, sorry.
What can we know, Margaret? What can we know mentally about what mind is? Don't give me any reference to the supermind.
No, it doesn't matter that she ever been understood, but I understood in steps. Even when I feel something, my mind is perceiving what is I feel physically.
Okay.
Or when I feel the energies, my mind reflects what I feel.
Excellent. So you've given two definitions.
Yeah.
Mind is sensation and perception.
Yes.
And
also the will and the intelligence.
Well, you said two things there. It's also the will and the intelligence. So, so what is it, actually? I mean, it's sensation, it's perception, and you say it's intelligence and it's will. So those are four things that you think mind is.
It's more than that, but he talks about this intelligence and this will. The intelligence.
Okay, but I'm asking you to reflect with your consciousness on what mind is.
It's the faculty of logic and reason. This is what I understand.
Okay. But it's also, as she said, sensation, because we know from our daily experience that I know that you're sitting there in that chair not because of my intelligence and my will, but because I perceive you. Absolutely, yeah, and I didn't make any distinction between animal intelligence or animal mind or physical mind. The reason why I asked you to read those two chapters in the Synthesis of Yoga is because Sri Aurobindo goes to enormous lengths to tell us that, first of all, mind is citta. The basis of all mind, he says repeatedly, is the citta. So let's try to focus on what mind is.
Yeah. Okay.
The whole thing.
Maybe I thought quite a long time what mind means. So could be the one thing is, I think I was 14 or 15 years, and when my cousins came, we played who's the quickest in mind, this game, back and forth. And I was quite quickly also with the mind and experience it. And then I felt that this is something so, obviously, when you have to win and go over the other one, so I dropped it. I said, I don't like to do it anymore. So,
so you didn't have a very strong will in that case. So.
Maybe today not, but at this time I'm quite strong.
Because the perception of competition was enough to discourage you. Oh, you were winning.
Yes,
so
yes.
You were bored. So you were bored with that game.
I don't know, but I was quite quick in. Then I said, but this, I don't like this kind of faculty fighting with each other or competition with each other.
So you had a preference.
Yeah.
And you made a judgment to reject one thing and to do another thing.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the intelligent will. But first of all, there was the physical environment which was known through vibrations that were stored so that from day to day when she went back to that experience, it was very familiar to her because it was a field experience. Was experiential happening, and that experiential happening was seen and heard and felt by your nervous system, and that's the basis of mind right there, and it's present in all animals from the earliest microorganism up until now, today, us. That
in this level you are going on another level. The dispute happens on another level, not on the physical perception.
No, but you were there in your body perceiving your friends playing that game and having perceptions of the sensations which were there.
It was on the mental level, it was not on my physical.
No, I know, but were you in the room? With your friends? You were playing a game with them, but you were not in the room? No, I'm asking you seriously.
No, and I seriously answer that there's another level where the intellector just can meet the intellector of the mind.
Let's take where we are right now then. We're having a little competition here. You want to go off on your track and I want to keep you focused. And we are... Do you see me in this chair? You don't?
No.
Why do you say no?
My perception is totally different than at this time.
No, but let's be right now. Okay?
I know I'm very much perceive the physical energy. Yes.
Yeah. So we are present in this room.
Yes.
And we are hearing each other's voices. And we are perceiving the light vibrations bouncing off of our colors. And we've been here before, so we're very familiar with this environment. And we have some basic understanding of why we're here, which we can perceive. We're in this room with these people because we want to explore the philosophy of evolution. Is that right? I didn't ask about will yet. I'm trying to focus on the plane of sensation and perception. So, if we focus on that plane, then we know where we are and who we are, and we have a memory of having been here before. And it doesn't seem strange and hallucinatory to us. We understand that we are present here in time and space right now. And that's a very fundamental content of the mind. We're in the body and we are perceiving the sensations that are around us and in front of us. And we are recalling unconsciously recalling our thoughts and feelings from other times, and we're even below that level remembering the distant past when you, for example, decided that you didn't want to play that competitive game. So something stimulated a memory that is buried deep in your consciousness that seemed to you to be relevant right here, right now, and we all heard it. Now, we can reflect on this process of communication, recall, memory, sensation, perception, and we can begin to reflect on how all of that is part of what we normally call mind. The mental being does all of those things all the time, at every instant. We are receiving sensations, we are perceiving those sensations, we are recalling formations unconsciously that give us a context that enables us to know where we are, what we're doing, and to get meaning out of it on a very simple level.
You know, propagates the notion of I.
Well, we haven't gotten to that point yet. That's another question. If we read the chapters which were assigned, which define citta and manas and buddhi, and I asked everyone to read those chapters carefully. The instruments of the spirit, the purification of the lower mentality, and the purification of the intelligence and will. Okay, three simple chapters in the synthesis of yoga, which give absolutely detailed descriptions of what mind is. And I suggested that we should think about it, reflect upon it, associate those definitions with our daily perceptions, and try to focus the mind on those patterns in us and around us all the time. They're going on all the time. So we are in a field of citta, manas, buddhi in the human sphere all the time. We're never anywhere else. That's what we are. And our whole organism is that. And every response and reaction and sensation and perception and image and idea and bit of reasoning that we do, whether it's unconscious or conscious, is that mind. And we need to live in the perception of that. We need to be aware of that, that mind that we are. We need to not have any doubts or uncertainties or misunderstandings about what we are. First of all, the first step. To be conscious every moment of what we are.
My question is, what is the difference between mind and heart mind? Because in all languages, there's a word for heart mind.
Well, and we have sense mind, and we have sense mind. Mm-hmm. Sense mind. What's the difference between sense mind and heart mind?
Well, to me, the heart is the center. Soul and heart go together.
Okay, but let's go away from the center. What's the sense mind?
I don't know.
Do you have sensations? Do you feel them? Do you know where they're coming from? Like when you feel that pen rubbing against your finger, do you know where it's coming from?
I hope I know where it's coming from.
Well, I hope you do too, because if you don't, you're in trouble. I feel my foot pushing against the chair here, and I'm rocking back and forth, and I'm aware of being in this chair and thinking about the difference between heart mind and sense mind. And as Vladimir said earlier, we could also think about rational mind. And if we think about rational mind for a moment, that shouldn't scare us or give us a feeling of straying from the right path or something like that, you know. Because the rational mind is what we try to use as much as we can in order to not make mistakes, in order to be on the right path, in order to have control of our behavior. We use the rational mind constantly. It's a very integral part of ourselves. And so when that heart mind is working not very deeply into the psychic, but it's working emotionally, then we use our rational mind to try to provide some balance, to get back into a more realistic perspective. You know, when that superficial heart mind gets overstimulated, then we can pull back.
I'm not sure if the heart mind can go to extremes, because in Greek, heart mind means nous, ignorance, nous. God's
well,
power.
If it's ignorant, then it must be able to go to extremes, wouldn't it?
No. Ignorance is without nous, without heart mind.
Oh, yeah.
What is nous?
It's mind, basically. Intelligence.
The word understanding has yet to be used by anybody. Is this the
okay? Would you like to introduce that word?
You know, after all is said and done, has been exposed by you and Marie and so on. There must ultimately come to us understanding of things which are beyond that which is supplied by the plant and the animal nervous.
So why don't we instead of going so far beyond, why don't we just try to understand what we're talking about?
The ability to do that is mine.
Do you understand what we're talking about?
I'm getting there a little bit.
It's not very complicated.
You see, he's... in this chapter, he's trying to tell us how to purify the lower mentality. But after reading the whole chapter, you feel it's really difficult.
Yeah.
Because sometimes... it's not, he puts it very simply, that's all, but in the last, when you observe yourself, sometimes you're driven so strongly by your vital mind or whatever you call it, this emotion is so strong that this emotion doesn't want to listen to your reason, or intelligence,
and
there's always this battle all the time, and that's actually the sadhana.
That's another subject. It's not exactly the one we're talking about, but that's true. And it's much easier to say things simply than to do things that are difficult. Yeah, but just because he can say it simply doesn't mean that it's easy to do. Right? So there's a complete difference between saying something simply and doing that thing which you say. Right? I mean, I'm sure that there were some smart guys at NASA that said they were going to explore to find out whether water was on the moon or not. That was easy to say. Right? And probably even to get financial appropriation to do it. But it's quite normal that when we have these ideas, these big ideas that are so easy to say, that we find them not so easy to do. I'm going to turn here to something which relates directly to what you just said, however. Okay, here's something related to what you said that I wanted to read. The mind of knowledge is perfected when it gets away from impression and dogma and opinion. Well, can you get away from impression and dogma and opinion? Is anyone here able to get away from mental impressions, dogmas, and opinions?
Robert, we do it every day. When you sleep, you get away from everything. You get off the mental mind. Every day.
So is your mind perfect when you're asleep?
No, not. Mind is absent.
Then I think that that's not really relevant to this statement.
This direction.
Okay, did you follow that exchange that we just had, Don?
Yes. If you put these three things on the shelf and go around and inquire and say, well, my impression was thus and thus, is it really a good impression? And make inquiries either by yourself or with the aid of others, then that is the getting away from that. The mind of knowledge is perfected when you get away from that by checking it out.
Note. So in order to get away from it, you need to know what it is.
Yes, really what it is.
Dogma, impression, right. Opinion. Right. You need to be able to reflect on the movements in you of sensation, perception. Oh, it's too cold in this house. I need to, turn on the fire. And then you get angry because when you get up to turn on the fire, you stub your toe and... then you have to be a little bit detached because you can't stop there. You'll freeze.
I have to be totally detached. I have to be totally free within.
So we need to reflect on our opinions, our dogmas, and our impressions, because, as Sri Aurobindo tells us so simply, the buddhi, the intelligence and the will, is burdened with a mixed and impure action. The key word is burdened. When we reduce it, the intelligence and the will, to its own proper forms, we find that it has three stages or elevations of its functioning, the buddhi. First, its lowest basis is a habitual, customary action which is a link between the higher reason and the sense mind. A kind of current understanding. There's that word, Don, understanding. Okay, between your reason and your sense mind, when you're on the way to light the fire and you stub your toe, you send a message to your sense mind saying, well, we stubbed our toe, but we're still going to go ahead and light that fire because getting warm is more important than being cold, no matter what happens on the toe level. You know, we're worried about the whole thing, the body. It's cold. So we stubbed our toe, now we're going ahead to get our body warm, and we know that we've got to light the fire in order to do that, because that's what our reasoning tells us to do. And it tells us to do that because we have a habit of doing it. Simple stuff. Every day, you go out and you ride your motorbike and you check the fuel. And if you don't check the fuel, you run out of fuel. And then you get angry because you ran out of fuel because you were too forgetful to check it before you left. And then you make a note to yourself to check the fuel. This understanding is in itself dependent on the witness of the senses. This is not difficult stuff. And the rule of action, which the reason deduces from the sense mind's perception of and attitude to life. Okay, the reason is a function of our mind which deduces from our sensations and perceptions a rule of action that determines our perception and attitude to life. We feel much better if we remember to check the fuel than if we forget and run out in the middle of the hot, dusty road. So we get a habit of regulating our behavior. And it's a complex action, mostly unconscious, of citta, manas, and buddhi, totally interrelated. And the citta is seated in the nervous system, which is made up of chemicals, and every time there is an impulse that from your intelligence to your body to open the gas cap, there's a process of phosphorus reduction which goes through the synapses of the brain that send impulses to your hands and your feet. And that physical basis is always functioning every time there's an action that comes from the human being. So there's physical memory made up of chemicals that are in the habit of releasing that stream of chemical and electrical energy in order to maintain the habitual pattern that you have learned to impose upon yourself so that you are adjusted to life and you survive and you don't just sit there in the road and let the sun fry you. You get a ride and you bring the petrol. And so there's this complex physical, vital, and mental exchange of energies is going on permanently in the human being. It's called mind. Let there be no confusion about it. And we can observe it constantly. And we can observe it in living nature around us constantly. The behavior of the cat and the mongoose is not much different, except that apparently they don't reason about these things apart from the actual physical stimuli. But we can reflect on things without physical stimuli because we have this more abstract reason, but it's really doing the same thing as all the rest is doing. So in the philosophy of evolution, this is a key issue. the connection between the manas and the buddhi is a big mystery for science. How does the reflecting mind happen to track all of these things all the time and know them, understand them, reason about them? Well, here's an explanation. Because that's part of mind. The buddhi is just part of the whole mental complex. It's not separate from the body and the life. The chemicals and the prana, which is moving you towards the realization of your needs, and the reflection of that process in your habitual reasoning, reflecting mind, are all the same process. And it's mind at a slightly more evolved level than the cat and the mongoose. But it works the same way, up to a point.
Can there be any impulse or movement of the human being which is not connected to the mind?
Right, well, not connected to the mind. Ooh, probably not. Probably not, because we are a mental being. Connected to the mind. Not only is it probable that there can be nothing which is not connected to the mind, but it's quite probable that there can be nothing which is not the mind. Not only not connected to the mind. Okay, now let's go a little bit further with the mind for a while. Yeah, and because we've been told that it's not a good thing. Which is absolutely false, by the way. Okay. Yeah, and so I'm going to jump up one more layer. It, this understanding, is not capable of itself forming pure thought and will, but it takes the workings of the higher reason and turns them into coin of opinion and customary standard of thought or canon of action. So this is something that the buddhi does. It forms an opinion about these things. These habitual actions that we form, we have opinions about. Like there's a good way to do it and there's a foolish way to do it. We make these judgments all the time, you know. I'm always being told that it would be better to it would be better to turn off the water tap when you're soaping the dishes instead of letting it run, you know. So we have opinions about how we're supposed to do things. And we have customary standards of thought or canons of action. A canon of action means a set of principles. It doesn't mean a boom boom canyon, you know. So we have sets of principles that we derive from our habitual life experiences that we believe are right. Now, here's the thing I wanted to get to. When we perform a sort of practical analysis of the thinking mind, the one we just read about, that forms opinions and makes reasoning judgments about how to control behavior and all of that. When we perform a sort of practical analysis of the thinking mind, cut away this element. This element of those vital habits and all those things that are preventing us from having clear understanding, because we're just driven to do things according to our habitual opinions about them, and our feelings and our needs and the fact that we're cold or hot. If we cut away this element, which feeds us impressions and everything, and hold back the higher reason free, observing and silent, even when we're running out of fuel on the road and we have a strong drive to kick ourselves for not checking before we left and all of that, if we hold the higher reason free and we observe that phenomenon and we observe our reactions to that phenomenon, and we don't allow ourselves to just automatically go into panic mode, because after all, the petrol is going to be there when we get there to bring it back, and the motorbike is still going to be there when we get back, and we can take as much time as we want to get to work, because nobody here is going to fire us if we're late. So we don't have to be sucked into that pattern of habitual thought response and to justify our mistakes. Well, I forgot that this morning because I was too busy boiling the milk, and then the phone rang, and I knew I should have put petrol into my motorbike before I left, but I just forgot about all of that. So here you are in the middle of the road, kicking yourself, and then remembering, and then patting yourself, and then justifying this whole pattern. Instead of doing all of that, hold the reason back free, observing and silent. If we do that, we find, and this is what I wanted you to be doing for the last 2 weeks, because Sri Aurobindo tells you that this is important to do. We find that this current understanding begins to run about in a futile circle. Futile means useless. Repeating all its formed opinions and responses to the impressions of things. Constantly. But incapable of any strong adaptation and initiation, as it feels more and more the refusal of sanction from the higher reason, it begins to fail. This circle of opinions and responses to impressions, to lose confidence in itself and its forms and habits, to distrust the intellectual action, and to fall into weakness and silence. The stilling of this current, running, circling, repeating thought mind, is the principal part of that silencing of the thought which is one of the most effective disciplines of yoga.
So he's saying when you do that, it can slowly lose and then become silent.
You don't have to do it slowly, you can do it immediately. In fact, you can develop a technique that becomes habitual. And if you do that, you start to discover what the term higher reason means. Because he said just a little bit earlier, the buddhi, the intelligent will, the will to not follow the circling patterns of impressions and opinions and judgments, the will to not follow those because you want to move onto another plane of higher reason, that's the intelligent will making a choice. Because at every moment, you can choose, unconsciously or consciously, to follow the impressions and the habitual patterns of response and the rationalizations and opinions, or you can decide not to do that. Well, that's good. That's exactly what we need to do.
It's called sleeping on it, isn't it?
No, not really. Maybe that's part of it. But that depends upon an instant, a decision of the moment. What's being recommended is that we create a permanent habit of not sanctioning that level of our habitual mind, life, body behavior. A permanent habit.
Yeah, it's always on. Basically, it's always on.
It's always on, but it's always possible to step up to that next level, which doesn't follow the pattern, which simply observes the pattern and doesn't respond and doesn't form opinions and judgments. So this yoga of knowledge, jnana yoga, circles back around and connects with the yoga of will, which is the first part of the synthesis of yoga. Right? And the yoga of the will is exactly this, but it is reinforced and initiated by the yoga of knowledge. The yoga of knowledge says that we can use the buddhi to step back, create the silence, observe the patterns of our mind field. Doesn't mean that they stop working, they keep working. We observe them, we don't attach ourselves to them. Even if it's a very intellectual preoccupation. However practical it is, or intellectual it is, or impinging on us from the sensorium. Absolutely. But the higher reason itself has a first stage of dynamic, pragmatic intellectuality in which creation, action, and will are the real motive, and thought and knowledge are employed to form basic constructions and suggestions which are used principally for effectuation. So this buddhi is what we use all the time to get us around. It makes us do things, important things, which we have to do because they're right. Okay, so it's a very pragmatic thing, this part of our mind, which is running our lives. So we set goals for ourselves, and we set ourselves in motion to carry out those goals constantly. Sri Aurobindo is suggesting that there are three levels, he says, and the highest level of the three is what he calls the third and noblest stage of the intellectual will and reason, is an intelligence which seeks for some universal reality, or a still higher self-existent truth. Self-existent truth. One which doesn't depend upon external senses and impressions. Something which is true in itself. It doesn't depend upon you getting to your goal on time to be true. It's already true in itself. And that is, for example, the will to manifest a healing power on earth. Just as an example off the top of my head. So one of the ways that you do that is to hop on your motorbike and rush down to quiet and give massages. And you know that you've got a list of people who have reserved your time and space down there to get the massages. And so you're completely focused on your habit of performing that service to people. And so you have to get there by 9 o'clock. But your higher reason is capable of stepping back from that drive and that justification that you have. And you're rehearsing in your mind everything that you learned about that person the last time you gave them a massage, so that this time you're really going to catch what's wrong there. But all of that is going on. But there is a universal divine will for healing in manifestation that's working through you, through all the other people who go to quiet to give treatment, to all the people who go to Jipmer to give treatment, to all the people that go to PIMS to give treatment, and to Johns Hopkins to give treatment, and all of those Tibetan yogi doctors who are prescribing herbs in the mountains. And there is this universal truth force manifesting in the human mind continuum to give healing, to bring healing, to do healing, to be healing. Why not tune into that And it takes you down there to quiet, and it gets you there on time, and it superloads you with sensitivity to execute your healing action. And when you get through with it, you're still exactly in the same energy field that you were in when you started. And you haven't been distracted by anything. Well, you've noticed everything and you've done everything that you needed to do what you did, but still, all the time you have carried this universal truth force of healing on the earth with you. And that's yourself. You're really that. All the other stuff that goes on in between is just a means for that. And it's true for building the international zone. It's true for constructing your habitat. It's true for arranging the economic basis for the universal township of Oroville to become a model of the future humanity. I mean, as long as you think it's a question of balancing the budget at the financial service, then you're going to be narrowing your field and you're going to be exposing yourself all the time to frustrations and probably making judgments about things that are slightly off center because your goal is to get through the morning and balance the budget, and you forget that there was that big fund over there that you could have drawn from, and so you're just into this doing your job as best you can. That's another level. And that's the normal level of the human beings functioning. But there is a higher level of universal reason that Sri Aurobindo says is the doorway to higher mind. And until you learn how to make this simple reduction, you can't open that doorway.
Isn't the fundamental question of, on one side, control, to be kind of the owner of one's action, and the other side, faith, and the flow which cares for the whole thing? Is it a fundamental attitude thing which has to be questioned between control and faith?
It's a little bit more complicated than that, I think, but that's a good starting point. I mean, the yoga of the will, it starts with faith. First of all, you have to believe what I just said, that there is a possibility of performing that reduction that opens a door to a higher, more universal truth force. It's not just an idea. So you have to have faith that that will work. And your habit of wanting to be in control and do things right may cut off both the faith and the possible elevation of the buddhi. But the faith factor comes in with will and with the psychic will. I mean, I was going to do that tonight, but since nobody had done their phenomenological exercise during the week. We'll get to the will next week. Well, but constantly, deliberately, so that we can really say what mind is and observe it continuously. Never stop observing it for a moment. And develop a habit of affirming its patterns without being identified with those patterns. Then Sri Aurobindo tells us in many of these chapters that one of the things that helps us to do that is that we have in us a psychic will to be divine, to be the divine. The psychic will is the will to be divine. And it's at the core of every being. And if we have that in us, if it's really what's behind everything that we do, then it's much easier to perform this higher mental reduction. Because that will is always present there. It's a peaceful presence in us that really doesn't want to follow the vital urge, and it really doesn't want to follow the mental, noble mental ideas about what's right and wrong and all of that. It really just wants to be divine. And so when that movement starts in us and all of those patterns and levels kick in, if we have that psychic will in us, it helps us remember that what we're really supposed to be doing is tuning in, using that buddhi, that intelligent will, to tune in to that universal truth consciousness level so that that energy can permeate all of those other levels and irradiate them with a universal truth. And he, one of the things he says that this does, it accomplishes, is calming, stilling, silencing the automatic reactions to sensations, the automatic perceptual process. He says in later writings, all the time, the sensations don't give us an accurate picture of what's in front of us. The perceptions don't give us an accurate interpretation of the sensations. And the mental, higher mental, buddhi idea formations don't give us a true idea of either the sensations or the perceptions. So, we are that. We are nothing but that. But we have the possibility of a step back reduction and opening above to universal mind. And universal mind is all of that and all of what's behind all of that. And so in Savitri, Sri Aurobindo can say, in Canto 5, he can say something about mind which is very interesting and which we don't realize most of the time, because when we think about mind, what we're thinking about is all of these things that we've been going over tonight. But mind is more than that. And so he says, just listen. Mind is a mediator divinity. Its powers can undo all nature's work. Mind can suspend or change Earth's concrete law. affranchised, that means given freedom, from earth habits, drowsy seal. The leaden grip of matter it can break. So we don't have to do all of these things that we think we have to do.
Which page is it, please?
84. 84. Indifferent to the angry stare of death. It can be indifferent to everything, including this. It can immortalize a moment's work. A simple fiat of its thinking force. The casual pressure of its slight ascent can liberate the energy dumb and pent within its chambers of mysterious trance. It makes the body's sleep a puissant arm. Hold still the breath, the beatings of the heart, while the unseen is found. The impossible done.
Is he talking about concentration?
He's talking about the buddhi, the intelligent will, what it is capable of at its highest. If we really want to find the unseen and do the impossible, the mind is capable of that much control over all of our habits, patterns, normal patterns of behavior, including the beating of the heart. It communicates without means. It can communicate without means. Without speech, without words, without signs, without internet. It can communicate without means the unspoken thought. We know that. We've experienced that. It happens all the time. We think things and we say things that somebody else has just thought and said. We discover things together that nobody speaks about. It moves events by its bare, silent will. It does it all the time.
Sounds like occultism.
I do this every day, openly. I make a formation about what should happen and how it should happen and when it should happen, and it happens like that. And I don't even have to be there. But it helps if I'm there. Because I just keep it in mind. I just keep the focus.
Well, it's okay in mind. When you make information,
of course, it happens. But then, what is the difference? Because we, when we surrender, we don't make formations. We leave it to the mother or to God. So I'm always hesitating between these two, making formation, it works, I know, and just surrendering. So what to do?
And for me, it's also a question with this.
I think you make the formation and then you surrender to the mother to carry it out. And if you have done that Buddhistic reduction, if you have stepped back from your own preferences and your own impulses and your own opinions and your own dogmas, and you have tuned in to universal truth consciousness, like the consciousness of healing, and you make a formation that somebody is going to be healed from that universal truth consciousness, and then you surrender that to the mother, who is the force of effectuation, then the person probably will benefit from that, especially if you're there administering the touch, because you're an expert at it, because you've been practicing it for your lifetime. But it doesn't mean that that whole formation was not originated by the thought, the idea. And Sri Aurobindo often speaks of the idea, capital I, dash, force. So, this is mind. This is a realm of mind that we've already evolved. We're not talking about occultism and higher spirituality or anything else here. This is within the range of normal yogic practice. This giant ignorance, well, we all know what that is, don't we? This giant ignorance, this dwarfish life, it can illumine with a prophet sight. P-R-O-P-H-E-T. The ability to see beyond the moment. I mean, I came in here 2 weeks ago and I said, this course in the philosophy of evolution has the goal of making us conscious evolutionary beings. Because I can see the possibility that the philosophy of evolution can do exactly that. Now, whether and to what extent that will be realized, I cannot say, but it was an inspired moment. So there's some hope. It may be totally delusional, you know, but I'm going to keep hammering away with the idea that it's possible.
You mean it came from the universal mind?
Yes. If it hadn't, I wouldn't be bothering. Because I don't think philosophy has ever accomplished very much. But that's because the way philosophy is normally practiced, academic philosophy, is that it believes its job is primarily to define as perfectly as possible the limits of the rational mind. That has been the job of philosophy for thousands of years. And I have on my wall 200 or 300 volumes of that practice. And I like it. There's no harm in it. But because it has succeeded in defining thoroughly the limits of the rational mind, there's a possibility that a philosophy of evolving beyond the limits of the rational mind could actually work. And we've been given some very good tools. So here, we're just collecting tools. Language.
And language
used for a purpose.
And the other thing is probably also that there is something higher. It's also the outer charter, that to be a living servant of divine consciousness. There must be divine consciousness there.
So we want to use language for the purpose of evolving consciousness, not just to share ideas and review theories and enjoy each other's company and tell jokes and do what we normally do with language.
So this mind is just one of the instruments of the spirit.
Right.
This fantastic mind.
Which mind? The higher mind?
This mind we call it...
The buddhi?
The pure, the what you just read in the...
The human mind?
Yeah.
In all of its... dwarfish glory?
No, the other power.
Yes, it's just an instrument of the spirit. Chitta, manas, buddhi, vijnana, they're just instruments of the spirit. And they have bad habits mostly.
And does he say similar things about the vital being?
Does Sri Aurobindo say anything about the vital being?
In this scope, as the mind.
Are you interested in the vital being?
Yeah, I mean, these are all instruments of the spirit.
Would you like for us to start working on the vital being instead of the mental being? We can think about it, but I'd rather work on the mental being for the moment. And one of the things that he tells us is that it has the capability of disciplining and lessening the pull of the vital being. And that's part of its work. So that's the thing we've been hearing about. What we have to do is experiment a little bit to see if this higher Buddhistic reduction helps us with respect to the power that the vital mind patterns have on us. Because they have a huge amount of power over us. But that's still mind, because mind in the human being is totally involved in the vital. So there's not much difference.
No difference, because...
There is a difference.
Difference,
not much.
Vital. It's larger on human scale, mm-hmm. human plane, right. than
But we're not talking about vital, I mean, we're talking about the human being. Okay? We have a certain vitality under our control, and its habits are the ones that affect the way we think and act and so on. And they mutually reinforce each other.
Exactly, but vital is the energy.
Yeah.
The energy is being great.
It's one of the energies.
Yes. That's very important.
And it's very important and it's very powerful.
Yeah, it's the reason why there's a blockade. You cannot touch vital before you master the mind.
Yeah, I have a question to all this.
You can touch the vital with just this simple Buddhistic reduction.
Yeah, but I mean,
already touches it, and it doesn't mean that the mind is mastered, completely mastered. It just means that we're using that faculty in us to slightly reduce the inertia of the vital patterns. and the mental, rational, lower mental patterns. We're just right now thinking about the possibility of using that to that movement between the rational buddhi and the higher mind buddhi, that which can become universalized and detached and open to a higher illumination. Just to remember that much and see if that affects those other levels of the mind patterns that we're observing in us and around us. Simple step.
But afterwards comes transformation. This is the main goal of our being here, to change.
Right.
To
so this is the hypothesis is that if we perform that simple action, that those transforming energies will begin to descend in us because we're not sanctioning with our buddhi all of the patterns that are already automatic in us. It could very well mean that. Now, I just want to leave you with one thought. We're going to be moving in the direction of the idea of the will. This is just an exercise to help us familiarize ourselves with what the will is, what part of the mind the will actually is. But theoretically, in evolution, in the philosophy of evolution and the science of evolution, the idea of the will is difficult to grasp. Vital will, free will, divine will, what is the role of the will in evolution? Is the species in its evolution driven by something other than the vital force? Is there anything in evolution up to humanity besides the vital will? Now, of course, we know that Sri Aurobindo says that the vital will is just an expression of the psychic will. The physical will is just an expression of the psychic will. The mental will is just an expression of the psychic will. There is an essential will in existence that expresses itself through the physical, through the vital, through the mental, and all of that covers it up completely, and it's, as Savitri says throughout cantos 3 and 4, the will comes down into the abyss, and from there on out, it's just physical, vital, and mental Mother Nature doing her work. And it takes a long time for the will to be divine to re-emerge at the top, okay? But what scientist is going to blink twice when you say that to them? The question is, that for the philosophy of evolution, and it's a very interesting question, and it has many dimensions. What is it that drives the species through its millennia of variations to survive? You know, Darwin made this beautiful statement that nature, which he referred to lovingly as she, always finds the right solutions to her problems. And this is a kind of omnipresent will to variation, adaptation, and selection. And she's doing this all the time. That's nature. And he says, excuse me if I seem to be deifying nature, but how else can we speak about this extraordinary phenomenon? Now we think about volonté, le volonté, the voluntary action. Do animals take voluntary actions? Or are they just driven by automatic energy patterns? Do human beings really take voluntary actions? Or are they just driven by energy patterns? Is there a psychic will, a vital will, a mental will, a divine will? Is universal will, integral will, supramental will, physical, vital, mental, supramental will? I have been asking us to try to focus our consciousness on what mind is. Little bit later on, we can ask ourselves to try to focus on what the will is. And if anything that Sri Aurobindo and Heidegger and Whitehead and Bergson has said about human consciousness, it's possible to know what it is if it exists. If it's there, we should be able to grasp its reality directly and say, this is it.
Will is action. It is a source.
Action is will.
It's a source of action as will.
Oh, the source of action is will. Okay. Is the source of every action, like when the current suddenly goes off and then we have to light a candle? Is that
it? It's true. There is one source of everything. So if you are patient, you can step by step arrive to the top. And
okay.
Finally, there is no other option.
If we perform this fundamental yogic movement of the Buddhistic reduction of the higher intelligence, that is to say, we apply the will to not run around in opinionated circles and dogmatic circles and impressionistic circles and perceptual and sensational circles. We apply the intelligent will to not do those things, but to step back with the higher intelligence and just observe those things peacefully, carry out all the different actions. Then we can start to try to observe where those actions are originating. And is the will in them good or evil, efficient or inefficient, mental or vital, spiritual or material? Where is it exactly? Where does the movement originate exactly? Well, if your ethical mind or your sense of propriety or your hurt feelings or your benevolent feelings or whatever are driving you to do something because it's right to do it, to observe that phenomenon doesn't mean that you interfere in doing it or not doing it. It just means that a part of you looks at it from a universal perspective. And so you register that you're not going to do that because you think it might offend someone. That doesn't mean that you should do it and offend them, or that you should not do it and not offend them. It just means that you become conscious that that in itself is just a certain part of your mind working in its conditioned pattern. And there's another part of you which is detached and universal and all-knowing that observes it. The universalized higher buddhi is something that we have access to. But it's interfered with by all the levels below it that have evolved these very complex structures that are just going on in their routines. So the most fundamental movement, Sri Aurobindo says, the most fundamental movement of yoga is that using the Buddhistic, the higher intelligent will to step back from all of that and hold that poise of that wider, calmer, detached poise. Very first step, before the higher mind energies can penetrate. And if the psychic will to be divine above all else is what's behind the effort, it's easier. Because it's right. Because it works. I always go 15 minutes overtime. Sorry to keep us here so late.
We had nothing better to do.
Which page? Which part? What's the instrument?